Welcome to Who's in STEM. I'm Ken Ono, your host and the STEM advisor to the Provost and the Marvin Rosenblum Professor of Mathematics at UVA. Our goal is to evoke flights of imagination and wonder by showcasing the cornucopia of all that is STEM at UVA, the marvelous world of UVA science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Erica and I, we're avid scuba divers. Now, our son, Sage, he's a pro scuba diver. He lives in Pacific Grove, California, a few blocks from the famous Monterey Bay Aquarium. And he spends hours each week underwater. And last week, he was in Hawaii collecting samples, night diving for the Smithsonian. The creatures that come out at night, you've got to see the pictures. They look like Pokemon creatures, but only with blinking neon lights. Our house is decorated with his photos of sharks, sea turtles, and delicate creatures called nudibranchs. Now, as a family, we've traveled far and wide for diving. Cozumel, Curacao, Hawaii, Fiji, and the Great Barrier Reef. Just to name a few, this is what we do. And in the 15 years we've been at it, regrettably, we've seen firsthand the effects of climate change. Coral reefs are struggling worldwide, and we're deeply worried about their future. And frankly, it is our future. We are worried. News of coral bleaching, the ubiquity of microplastics in the world's oceans, the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, sea level rise, these stories populate our news cycles, and they are very real. We've seen it. It's all very scary. And today, to celebrate Earth Day, so maybe part of it isn't celebration, maybe it's an awakening. To celebrate Earth Day 2024, we're taking a deep dive. It's a pleasure to speak with star UVA environmental scientist Scott Doney. He is the Joe and Helen Kington Professor in Environmental Change. Scott, welcome to Who's in STEM.
Oh, thanks, Ken. It's great to be here.
So, Scott, you've had quite the career. Let's see, NCAR, the National Center for Atmospheric Research, the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute, the White House, and of course, UVA. What's more, well, it's the eye-popping list of your leadership roles at these places. Let's see, Department Chair and Institute Director at Woods Hole. President Obama nominated you for Chief Scientist at NOAA. President Biden named you Assistant Director of Ocean Climate Science at the White House. Scott, what's your superpower? Doesn't sound real.
Well, I wouldn't say it's a superpower. I'm really curious about a lot of things, so I can't stay on one science subject for very long. But the other thing I like to do is explain technical subjects to different audiences. And sometimes that's connecting one group of scientists with another group of scientists. And sometimes that's connecting scientists with the general public or policymakers or the media. And that sort of – that ability to communicate, and I won't say I'm always good at it, but that ability does sort of push you forward into leadership roles.
Yeah, it's actually very important being able to communicate science, disseminate our findings. Without that skill, what could be the point, right? We don't work in a vacuum. So, Scott, no beating around the bush. To celebrate Earth Day, what is your take on climate change? What should we be doing, and what should we be doing now?
So we've understood the basics about Earth's climate for a long time, right? The sun heats up the Earth, heats up the air, the water, the ocean. That heat has to escape back to space. To have a stable climate, the energy being absorbed from the sun has to be balanced by what we call long-wave infrared radiation. So if you've ever seen like a crime drama where they point the infrared camera at the building and you can see the people because they're warmer.
Right.
Same thing. The planet heats up. Now, the third element is that in the atmosphere, there are gases, these heat-trapping or greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide or methane. And as those build up, it makes it harder for the planet to lose that heat back to space. And since the Industrial Revolution, we've been pumping huge amounts of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere when we burn fossil fuels, coal, natural gas, oil. We're also releasing a lot of methane. And over time, that buildup of those gases leads to a warming of the planet. Now, since I started looking at this, you know, sort of in the early 80s, the big change is that, one, the signal has gotten a lot bigger, right? Mm-hmm. These are cumulative effects mm-hmm. of using fossil fuels. The other is we have much better observing networks, whether it's satellites or ships or robots at sea, mm-hmm. land-based records. And as you mentioned at the beginning, we're seeing the impacts, you know, warmer temperatures on land, longer droughts, heat waves. We're seeing huge changes in the ocean as the ocean warms up. I do a lot of work in the Antarctic, and we're seeing melting back of glaciers and disappearance of ice sheets and ice shelves around the continent, also with Greenland. So the evidence
even here in North America, Glacier National Park in Montana, well known for glaciers, will soon be without glaciers.
Yeah, my brother actually lives in Great Falls, the gateway to Glacier National Park. And
we don't want to ever call it the park that formerly had glaciers. Yeah.
So you have very strong theoretical basis. You have this incredible observational record. So then the question is, what's the future going to look like? And that really depends on people's choices, right? If we continue to burn fossil fuels to drive our energy system, our transportation system, our economy, the climate's going to continue to change. So the solutions are things like renewable energy for our power grid, electrifying our transportation system, changing our agriculture system to try to reduce emissions of methane and other greenhouse gases. And a lot of that is along the way, but there's still a lot of work to do.
Thank you. Thank you, Scott. So I do want to emphasize this is not just your individual opinion. You speak from a position of authority. And as I alluded to a moment ago, you were the most recent assistant director for ocean climate science policy at the White House. So to follow up, let's do a deeper dive here. So you were just telling us about how to think about what climate change is, the anecdotal evidence that's all around us. What did you do at the White House? Let's dig in a little bit. You're the world expert.
So the president has a science advisor. The current advisor is Dr. Aarti Prabhakar, and she runs what's called the Office of Science and Technology Policy. So basically, it's a think tank in the White House that tries to help the public, American industry, but also the federal government as a whole think about what are the challenges for science and technology? How do we move forward to use that science and technology to improve our lives and our livelihoods? And so within this big organization, I worked for a division that looked at the climate and the environment. So trying to figure out, you know, what are the best investments moving forward? How could we use the science knowledge that's being developed? And so I worked in one little corner on the oceans, but I was working with people, for example, one of the big advances while I was there was improving the connections to tribal nations and how we use indigenous knowledge. And that's really important for the climate space because tribal nations and indigenous peoples actually have a lot of the knowledge about the environment and how the environment has changed over long periods of time. Right. So Western science is really useful, but we need to meld that with indigenous knowledge.
Right. Here at UVA, in one of our earliest episodes of Who's in STEM, we had your department chair, Howie Epstein, on his research. If I remember correctly, just won a major prize from the university, a collaboration with engineers and architects precisely in indigenous communities in Alaska. So that's something that's, we're very proud of here at UVA. So the Office of Science and Technology Policy, there are presumably some policymakers, but who works there? Is it mostly world experts such as yourself?
There are some people who come in from the outside. So people from universities or from non-governmental organizations. A lot of people are what we call subject matter experts from the federal government. Mm-hmm. So they're people with policy backgrounds or detailed technical backgrounds. In fact, Professor Andres Clarence here from UVA just mm-hmm. joined another part of OSTP, I think just last week or the week
That's
before.
Right.
So he's going to be looking at, he's going to work in innovation and industry and bring his engineering skills to some of these problems.
That's right. So you were identified for your expertise in ocean science. So were you given a particular charge? Was there a report you had to produce for the
yeah.
for the president? Exactly.
Yeah. So there were two things that I worked on that I'm particularly proud of. One was the Ocean Climate Action Plan. And this is the idea that, you know, there's lots of things that can be done on land, you know, with power plants or transportation, but there's lots of things that can be done in the ocean as ocean solutions. And this is everything from nature-based solutions, such as preserving marshlands mm-hmm. and seagrass beds and mangrove forests, or even restoring them, all the way to offshore wind and maritime shipping. Maritime shipping is a big issue because the fuels that drive the huge cargo ships that cross the Pacific and Atlantic, that interconnect countries and the economy, right now use a type of fuel called bunker fuel.
Bunker fuel. Okay.
It's almost like asphalt. You kind of have to heat it up to make it liquid. But these ships are crucial to our global economy, and there's not an easy way to transition them. You can't electrify them. You can't put enough batteries on this enormous ships. So people are trying to work on green shipping. So we worked on this Ocean Climate Action Plan. Was what can the federal government do to push forward, you know, everything from what we call blue carbon, mm-hmm. better wetlands, protected mm-hmm. wetlands, mm-hmm. to offshore wind, to green shipping. And then we also looked at how can communities adapt? How can we have climate-ready fisheries? Mm-hmm. You know, fisheries are very important in the U.S. for regional economies and for our seafood and for our food supply. And how can we protect those fisheries from future climate change?
So did your group assemble a report, like a white paper? Was something that we could read online?
So the Ocean Climate Action Plan is out there. It's unfortunately much longer than we wanted because it's got, you know, a detailed technical appendix. But we organized a group of about 30 subject matter experts from all of the different federal agencies that touch the ocean. And then we worked with those subject matter experts and folks in the White House to write this report. Mm-hmm. And we were really happy. It came out last year in March at Conservation Day.
Okay. What's the name of the report for people who want to look it up?
The Federal Ocean Climate Action Plan.
Great. So what are the main recommendations? If you had to pick just the four or five main takeaways, recommendations.
One is to continue to invest in offshore wind.
Mm-hmm.
So we need renewable energy. There's often good reasons why offshore wind can be quite beneficial because it's not competing for other land space and other land uses.
Mm-hmm.
Winds over the ocean are often stronger and more consistent.
Mm-hmm.
And there are opportunities not just within the continental U.S., because the one thing that I think is really important is when we look from the White House, we're looking at not just the continental U.S., but we're looking at Hawaii, Alaska, the U.S. territories, Puerto Rico. And so, for example, for many of the parts of the U.S. territories, there aren't as many options for other fuel sources. So that's one. Another place that we look that's probably a little bit more controversial is carbon dioxide removal. So there's sort of two ways to solve this problem. One is to burn less fossil fuels by replacing it with renewables or being more efficient, using energy more efficiently. The other approach that shows up in some of these climate scenarios is, can we actually actively draw carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere? And it's not clear
yet. At scale. At real scale.
Yeah. The currently, we emit about 37, 38 billion tons of carbon dioxide per mm-hmm. year to the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And we would need to do this at the billion ton per year scale. This is right now a science and engineering question of, is this feasible what are the environmental impacts? What are the social impacts? And so that sort of led to the second report that I worked on, mm-hmm. which is really thinking about how climate action and our work in the ocean connects with environmental justice. Mm. So one of the recommendations from our climate report was we should look at ocean justice.
So that's an odd term. I think most people haven't heard that before. What is ocean justice?
Environmental justice deals with the fact that many of these environmental challenges, whether it's climate change or pollution or coastal habitat destruction, is really disproportionately affecting some communities. And these are often communities with large numbers of people of color, with people with less resources, more poverty, more social injustice. And so what we want to do is figure out how can we improve the environment without harming the communities that we're trying to protect? And so a good example is in the Gulf of Mexico, where you have many communities that have suffered from the impacts of the oil and gas industry.
Right.
And we don't want to simply replace the oil and gas industry with new industries, for example, pumping carbon dioxide offshore into the seabed.
Right.
So we want to develop solutions that are more just. So we developed a report that looked at all sorts of different ways that the federal government could improve equity and opportunity across the board.
You know, Scott, thank you for your service. These are certainly issues that are quite local. In addition to the Gulf of Mexico, here in Virginia, a lot of our faculty, for example, in the Link Lab and in your department, we think very deeply about environmental justice on the Virginia shore. So, we look forward to seeing what we could do here in the Commonwealth to hopefully live up to the recommendations provided by your report.
And if I can just, the Virginia shore is you have this nexus of, you know, you have the world's largest Navy base and a huge employer in Norfolk.
Right.
You have communities that are suffering from sea level rise already. You have the Port of Virginia that is being hurt by sea level rise. And there's
all the economic issues. All the Chesapeake Bay, right.
And so how do you do that? How do you support national security? How do you support the economy? And how do you support those local communities in a fair and just way?
Great questions. Scott, so thank you for your service on behalf of the country, honestly. What's it like working at the White House? Did you meet the president? Two presidents. Have you met the president?
I have not. Unfortunately,
you have to go back.
It sounds like a West Wing episode. I mostly worked remotely, so I mostly was sitting in a home office doing a lot of stuff on Zoom. It sort of felt like the pandemic. I did get up to DC a few times. Mm-hmm. It's a great group. I mean, everybody who works in OSTP is really passionate. They're really committed. We also work a lot with the Council for Environmental Quality. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I haven't gotten to meet the president. I have briefed members of Congress mm-hmm. and their staff,
right.
which is another really important element of that job.
So just a little side note, the Office of Science, Technology, Policy, OSTP at the White House actually isn't in the White House. It's in the building next door to the White House, which is called the Executive Building. I think it's the Eisenhower Executive Building of the White House. But these are all very storied grounds. And so, like I said, thank you for your service. So as a faculty member here at University of Virginia, I like to talk to our guests about their personal histories, right? So your experience covers a spectrum. It's really kind of amazing. Ranges from academics, national labs, to government, and now here to the University of Virginia. I think we can make a movie about your life, right? How do you become a distinguished scientist? It almost looks like you get, I don't want to say bored because, right, you know, the earth is not a boring place, but the kind of challenges that you've gone after and addressed in your career cover the spectrum. Can you walk us through that journey? I mean, maybe even beginning in high school. In high school, were you thinking about becoming an environmental scientist? Tell us your story.
So I was really fortunate. I grew up in Los Angeles, and my grandmother lived near the beach.
Yeah, that sounds fortunate.
Yeah. And I worked, I was a Boy Scout, and I got a job at a Boy Scout camp on Catalina Island. Oh. And so that exposed me to a lot of, you know, ocean things. You know, we had classes, we taught classes on oceanography and just environmental sciences and water in general. So I kind of knew I wanted to go in that direction. And then I was incredibly fortunate towards the end of my undergraduate, I went to UC San Diego. And at the time, they didn't have environmental sciences as a major, but I got a summer internship at a NASA lab in New York City. It's the Goddard Institute for Space Studies. Okay. It's actually over the diner. If you've ever seen the comedy show Seinfeld, there's a diner.
I know the diner, yeah.
The NASA building is that's actually the NASA building above. They're in the office building above. And that exposed me sort of climate and climate modeling and atmospheric dynamics. And so then I went to grad school as an oceanographer and then sort of jobs and traveling around. But yeah, I've always been interested in the ocean in one form or another.
Right. And as a graduate student, there are many ways in which you can study the ocean, right? So what kind of scientist are you as an ocean scientist, right?
So I guess I would say I was a blue water oceanographer and not a marine biologist. Ah. So my undergrad degree is in chemistry.
Got it.
So my thesis advisor is actually a nuclear physicist. And so he figured out ways of measuring isotopes of hydrogen and helium in the ocean that can be used to track ocean physics and ocean biology, all sorts of interesting stuff. And so I did a mix
of— questions motivated him? This was a different generation, right? This was before we were talking about climate change, or maybe this was the beginning of that. What questions drove his work?
He worked in a lab in Canada where, unfortunately, when we were exploding nuclear weapons, doing atmospheric testing of nuclear weapons, we were releasing a lot of radioactivity. And some of that radioactivity is in the form of a radioactive isotope of hydrogen called tritium. And so his advisor in Canada was using tritium, was one of the people who was making measurements of tritium and its daughter product, a rare isotope of helium called helium-3, and trying to, in some sense, make some good of the fact that we'd released all this tritium into the environment because it tracks well with water.
Right.
And then you can use the helium-3 to actually figure out how old water parcels are in groundwater or in the ocean.
Wow. Okay.
And so my advisor and his advisor built mass spectrometers. You couldn't order a helium mass spectrometer from a company. You had to build it from scratch. So he would do his own circuit boards, his own design, vacuum pumps, the whole bit.
So with your graduate training, it doesn't sound at the outset that you would become an ocean scientist. So how did – like what were your first discoveries as an ocean chemist that led you to become – this champion of climate change?
I have to admit, I had been exposed to climate, but at the time, there wasn't a lot of – I'd say that there was some poo-pooing within the ocean academic community of climate change research. It was too applied. You know, it wasn't fundamental science. And so I was interested in what you might call tracer oceanography. Mm-hmm, so my first big field experiment during my graduate career was we went from Iceland to the equator, and I collected samples for tritium and helium-3, that rare isotope that tritium decays into, and also chlorofluorocarbons. And basically, I was trying to track how did water get from the surface of the ocean into the deep sea in the Atlantic.
These dynamics, right?
Yeah.
Right.
But that background in physical oceanography really helped later on when I started to think about the carbon cycle and climate problems.
Right. So you're well known for did you invent the term acidification of the ocean?
No.
Is that do I have that wrong? Well, tell us about that story though. Yeah.
So carbon dioxide gets emitted to the atmosphere when we burn hydrocarbons.
Right.
Carbon dioxide combines with water. This is the same thing that happens in a carbonated beverage. They just bubble carbon dioxide into your soda, and it forms a weak acid, carbonic acid. And chemical oceanographers have known this for a long time, you know, dating back to, you know, Roger Revell in the 1950s, that the ocean holds a lot of inorganic carbon. What people didn't fully understand is that marine life is actually pretty sensitive to how much carbonic acid is in the ocean, because it changes the acid-base chemistry. If anybody's ever had an aquarium, you know, if you the pH changes, it can have big effects. And in the early 2000s, people were really starting to think about the implications of ocean acidification for marine life and for ocean ecosystems as a whole. And this is another one of those serendipity moments. I happened to be talking to someone. I was at a training session on science communication and science policy, and I met a person who was an editor for Scientific American. And she thought this was a really interesting story. I had first tried to talk about helium isotopes, and they didn't think that was very interesting. But they were quite interested in ocean acidification, so I wrote a article in Scientific American and actually ended up changing some of my research path forward to work more on ocean acidification. And then that's led into recent work on carbon dioxide removal, because that's sort of connected, you know, ironically, ocean acidification is where we have too much carbon in the ocean. The carbon dioxide removal people are proposing schemes that would actually suck up even more carbon dioxide from the atmosphere as a short-term solution. But what's the damage that's going to do to the ocean?
Yeah. The ocean isn't infinitely deep, right?
And the sad commentary used to be for the ocean that dilution is the solution.
Oh, right.
That the ocean is infinite. What we found is that the ocean
is not
infinite.
Right.
And it's more fragile to human impacts than we probably originally thought.
Right. And the clock is ticking. So our time is wrapping up here. I do want to talk about the Department of Environmental Science. I'd like to hear about what it's like to join this department. You haven't been here at UVA very long still. What drew you to University of Virginia?
I had been doing research for a long time, and I wanted to be someplace where my research could make a difference. And when I saw UVA, I saw an opportunity to take my work in the natural sciences and connect with people doing policy, with people doing law. And I was really attracted by the emergence of this environmental institute that UVA has put together as a way for me to take stuff out of the lab, take stuff out of the field, and make a difference in people's lives.
What's the work that's going on in the department? Tell us about it.
So one of the things I really like about the Department of Environmental Sciences is that, you know, unlike some universities where environmental folks are spread all over the place, we have a really good department, but we're pretty small and we're all together. So we have ecologists, we have geologists, we have atmospheric scientists, some ocean folks like me, all together. And so that leads to a lot of collaborations. There's a big collaborative effort down on the Virginia Eastern Shore. So UVA has a shore lab. And for several decades now, our department's been leading efforts to understand how that system works with lagoons and barrier islands. A lot of work on looking at the lagoon system there lost its seagrasses because of disease many decades ago. And there's been an effort to restore those seagrasses and see how that improves the environment, stores more carbon, makes more habitat for many organisms.
Right. We, in fact, featured Karen McGlathery a few months ago, and she was telling us about that work. It's fascinating. Now to wrap up, we've talked about your research, your work in the White House. We've talked about climate change. I think these are great topics for Earth Day, this episode. To wrap up, I would like you to talk about your teaching and your mentorship. Right? This comes up a lot when I talk to others in administration about what you've brought to UVA. How do you get students involved in your work? Tell us about that.
So, well, I really enjoy teaching. And so this semester, I'm teaching the Introduction to Environmental Sciences course. So part of this is to get kids who aren't going to go into STEM fields some background. And then some of it is to get kids who are interested in STEM interested in the environmental sciences versus other options. We try to fold undergraduates in as much as possible. So our department and many do have a distinguished majors program. Mm-hmm. So one of my students, who's Sarah Lang, who's now a graduate student at University of Rhode Island, she did such a spectacular sort of independent research project over a couple of years that she actually was able to write a paper on it. Mm. And so that paper
over
came
a couple
up.
Of years. So did you start mentoring her as a second year, something like that, or
either a late second year or okay. a third year? And okay. then she did her basically her senior thesis in her fourth year, and she got a Virginia Space Grant funding cover some of her summer salary so she could continue that. It's just great. There's just a lot of opportunities for students to engage in research.
So for undergraduates who might be listening, how could they find out more about these opportunities? How could they be the next Sarah Lang?
Well, I do try to, and in many of the faculty in my department, we try to put stuff up on our web pages of mm-hmm. what our current research programs. Mm-hmm. Every winter, we have Enviro Days, which is a student-led day-long symposium for environmental sciences, but it's not just folks from our department. People from engineering, from architecture will come, and we basically listen to student talks and student posters, and they bring in a keynote speaker, so that's a great way. And then just come over and talk to faculty in our department.
Right. So I'm often right outside the department headquarters. You know, I have an office in the math department. I get my coffee there. But I will say it's a very welcoming department. You walk into the building and there's a giant flat screen TV, usually with a smiling face of some environmental scientist who's going to give a talk that day. So this department, they invite you, students, if you're listening. So Scott, your scientific contributions, the telling of your personal journey and your dedication to UVA and the health of our planet, it's all super. It's all inspiring, and it perfectly aligns with President Ryan's vision for UVA to be great and good in all that we do. I'm Ken Ono, STEM advisor to the Provost and the Marvin Rosenblum Professor of Mathematics, and it's been a pleasure having Professor Scott Doney with us today in celebration of Earth Day.
Who's in STEM is a production of WTJU 91.1 FM and the Office of the Provost at the University of Virginia. Who's in STEM is produced by Catherine Kosseboom, Claire Curzan, Rhea Verma, Mary Garner McGee, and Ariane Ballou. Our music is composed and performed by Robert Schneider and John Ferguson of Apples and Stereo. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Listen and subscribe to Who's in STEM on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be back soon with another conversation about scientific technological innovation at the University of Virginia.